This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Hello, welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. Now you can speak.
I'm not your grandma.
I'm not your grandma. And we are here with another Not Your Grandma, Dr. Lisa Wolf. So let me tell you a little bit about Lisa. Lisa, let me tell you about you, according to your bio from your website, your Oklahoma City University website. Lisa Wolf is a professor of Hebrew Bible, endowed chair at Oklahoma City University in, you guessed it, Oklahoma City. She has been on their faculty since 2007. She's the author of a commentary on Ruth, Esther, Song of Songs, and Judith. The video series, Uppity Women of the Bible, and she's working on more Uppity Women. That's a four-part series, right, so far? And then two chapters in the book, The Dead Sea Scrolls, Fragments in the Museum Collection from the Museum of the Bible. And then her most recent work, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, is a feminist commentary on Qohelet, which is also known as Ecclesiastes, more commonly in lay circles, from the Wisdom Commentary series of Liturgical Press, which was just released and is available now for around $30 or so. You have your undergraduate degree from University of Colorado at Boulder. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You did your master's work, Master of Divinity at United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. And finally, your doctoral work in a joint religious studies program at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary and Northwestern University. Lisa, is there anything else we should know about you?
Probably so, but that's a pretty good intro. Those are all correct pieces of information.
You did it.
I just fact-checked your own self-written bio.
No way. Right.
So, all right. Well, let's talk.
Ordained in the United Church of Christ.
Oh, that's right. So, you are ordained. Yeah. Yes. So, all right. Well, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for being on here.
Thank you. Not my grandma's Bible study, but my grandma, I think, would like this Bible study.
Yeah. My grandma probably wouldn't.
Oh, okay.
Depends on your grandma.
One of my grandmas certainly never opened a Bible, which is not judgment. I think it's just fact. But, okay, so let's talk about Qohelet/Ecclesiastes.
All right.
First of all, where does the name Qohelet come from?
So Qohelet is the Hebrew name of the book, which is taken from the opening line of the book. The words of the teacher, it says in the New Revised Standard Version, but the word in Hebrew is Qohelet. Mm-hmm. And so typically in the understanding of the Hebrew tradition in Judaism, you take the title from the opening line of the book, often the first couple of words. So Qohelet is known as both the book and the author. Mm-hmm. And I decided to have the book titled primarily Qohelet with Ecclesiastes in parentheses, because Ecclesiastes, over the centuries, gained a very Christian connotation. Mm. Because in Christianity, ecclesial is the reference to the structure of the church. And so I think it anachronistically suggests that the book is Christian, when in fact it is not.
Right.
Well, it is part of Christian tradition, right, to the extent that the canon is part of Christian tradition. That's right. I wanted people to not read Christian assumptions into the book. And I think it can be really helpful to remind people that this book was written in Hebrew and it has its own context too. And so as to not misappropriate Christian assumptions and theology and so forth. So kind of like, that's also why I tend to refer to the Old Testament as the Hebrew Bible, even though I know there are really good arguments for calling it the Old Testament. But I think Hebrew Bible, especially for a Christian audience, actually reminds them that it had its own time and place. It has its own language. And let's try to let that speak for itself. And so that was my decision to, that's why I decided to make a case to call the volume Qohelet with Ecclesiastes in parentheses. So the word Qohelet is interesting because it is not entirely clear what it means.
Oh, that's nice.
But it's something like, teacher is not a bad translation. Some translations say preacher. that I think is also anachronistically Christian and probably not, doesn't really fit the context. I date the book to about the 3rd century BCE. Mm-hmm. And so I think philosopher would work.
Ooh.
It's somebody who's assembling a group and speaking to a group of people. So if we're in the Hellenistic period, I think philosopher would kind of fit. Now, the book that I wrote is part of a feminist commentary series called the Wisdom Commentary Series. So the interesting thing about the word Kohelet for a feminist commentary series is that in the Hebrew, if we pick apart that word Kohelet, it's a feminine participle.
Right, yeah.
So anybody who studied any language that has gendered nouns will tell you they don't necessarily mean anything about biological sex or sociological gender.
Right.
But, I mean, if you're going to be a feminist commentator, you might as well think about that a little bit. Yeah. Right. And there are some parts of the book that also, interestingly, contribute to the idea of a more feminine Kohelet. So there's a passage late in the book where there's, some people might call it a mistake, but the verb that's used with Kohelet is a feminine form of a verb. And so...
Interesting.
Yes, exactly. So,
a mistake that continued, I'm assuming, to be copied exactly how it was and nobody tried to fix it, or...
Right, so it's one letter where if, depending on if it goes on the end of one word or the beginning on the, of the other word, it could be the feminine form of the verb or the definite article of the noun. So that's kind of interesting to think about. There's another place also in the book where the gender of the audience is suggested as feminine. And so one author, Jennifer Cousid, has talked about this as gender slippage. And I think those are interesting things to play with, especially for feminist commentary. Sure. So that's definitely something I play with here. And I made the decision to identify the author as Kohelet and refrain from using gendered pronouns through the book for the author in order to do a sustained exercise of entertaining the possibility that maybe Kohelet wasn't necessarily male, or at least open that as an option.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'm learning a lot already.
I knew some of it. I knew about the fact that Kohelet was, the word is structured as a feminine. I wonder too if there's, I think, and I'm not sure if this is in Hebrew Bible, or if there's some New Testament cases of this as well, but women writing under male pseudonyms in the sense too. So, you know, taking the title of the teacher, but the, you know, the word itself is feminine. So it's kind of this mysterious identity of the person.
Some argument, I cannot remember who, I feel like the name begins with a C, which is not useful. But somebody's arguing that Pseudophilo might be written by a woman because there's so much feminine imagery that seems out of place for a man to know or to care about. Which, I mean, it's not impossible that it was, but I mean, I think that's really, really interesting that there might be some more hidden women in there than we give credit to.
So there are a couple of authors who have briefly entertained that idea for Kohelet, and I definitely invite those arguments here. I had one student, a seminary student years ago, Shonda Adams, who suggested that Kohelet was kind of like Stephen Colbert, the late night comedian.
Yeah.
And that Kohelet was a woman doing an impression like Stephen Colbert, making fun of a man who was very misogynistic, as we see in, especially in chapter 7 of this book. And so I mentioned that. I think that is a fun thing to kind of think about. Another woman, Linda Sweeney, a friend of mine at the temple in town, she said, no, I don't think so, because if it were a woman who were trying to do satire, she would not have gone that far. And I think that's a good point, too.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point, if the satire is lost on the audience, it was not useful at all.
Right.
So
it's like watching the Colbert Report for real news.
Yeah.
From a conservative perspective, when really right. he's making fun of that. So, right. Yeah.
So I think one of the descriptions I like best is from my friends in Oklahoma City, Rabbis Abby Jacobson and Juan Mejia, who talk about, they compared Kohelet to a medieval Jewish prayer in which there is some gender slippage in the pronoun use for the deity. Mm-hmm. And they talk about it as gender bending. Mm-hmm. And Jennifer Cusid talks about that a little bit too. And so I think to entertain those possibilities with Kohelet is kind of a fun thing to do, especially it can be a little bit of a resisting reading in the light of a book that has, as I say in my opening line of the commentary, this book has been deadly for women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Well, should we talk about a few passages or a few interesting points of the book?
Sure. Well, so we have to talk about Deadly for Women, since I said
yes.
that.
Yes.
But we also have to talk about Hevel. Yes. So what first?
Deadly for Women.
Deadly for Women. Yeah. Okay. So this is a passage in chapter 7. And it's 7:26. I found more bitter than death the woman who is a trap, whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. One who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. See, this is what I found, said the teacher, adding one thing to another to find the sum, which my mind has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. So you laugh, but so in the 15th century,
Left
a very, very popular book, right up there with the Bible, was the Malleus Maleficarum. And if your Latin is good, you'll know that means the hammer against witches. So this was a handbook used by witch hunters. I mean, this is real stuff. Yeah. And seriously, it was almost as popular as the Bible in the early days of the printing press, right? So, and it was popular into the 18th century. So for several centuries, and tens of thousands of people died during the so-called Great Witch Hunt in Europe in particular. People died in what they would have called at the time the New World. Of course, it wasn't new to the people who already lived here, but you know about the Salem witch trials and so forth. So this book, the Malleus Maleficarum, drove those witch hunts and supported it in a kind of a textual form. And that verse, 7:26, from the Malleus was repeated four times.
Wow.
That verse was repeated four times in the Malleus Maleficarum, and I actually excerpt that portion of the Malleus in my commentary so that people can see that. So that's what I mean when I say this book has been deadly for women. It really was used for the sake of, probably they would have killed those women anyway. Some men were killed in the witch hunts too, but primarily women. And it's hard to know exactly how many, but definitely those verses were taken very literally in order to help drive the death and destruction of the so-called witches. Now, I try to unpack that verse to find out maybe what did it mean in its own context, in its own time. And to me, one thing that's pretty compelling is to think about that verse in comparison to the figure we meet in Proverbs, who is often referred to as Woman Folly, but she has different names. She's the strange woman. She's the unfaithful woman. There's a kind of a conflation of bad women, if you will, in Proverbs, who are set over against woman wisdom. They're a foil for woman wisdom. And so I talk about the possibility that that's what Kohelet was talking about, was woman folly here. Another possibility is that Kohelet was talking about woman wisdom, because right preceding that passage, Kohelet repeatedly says, I can't find wisdom. I can't find wisdom. I'm searching. I'm seeking. So that verb for found repeats in that section. And Kohelet's so frustrated at not being able to attain wisdom, that may be where it comes from. But I think it's like so many other Bible passages that have been deadly for people, whether it's Joshua and Judges and the way they drove manifest destiny and death of indigenous people, because the dominant imperialistic culture came in feeling justified by biblical texts, it doesn't get the author off the hook, really. You know, it still was created in a culture that allowed somebody to say something like that in a way that was gendered. Mm-hmm. And so it still is dangerous material for us.
I mean, it's not a big step to go from a metaphor where woman is victim to a reality where woman is victim or something like that. I mean, it's, if that's what you want to do, you're going to find a text to support it because of the way these types of passages are gendered. And so even saying Kohelet's talking about a metaphorical woman and maybe even metaphorical woman wisdom and a positive woman, the fact that it's the way that it's written can be used to justify that type of violence is something to be on guard about. It doesn't excuse any of it, but it does recontextualize it, but it doesn't excuse it. So,
well, and it really, you can't create that kind of a metaphor unless you're starting from a fairly misogynistic context in the first place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it tells us something about that too. There's a really interesting quote that I use from Louise Erdrich about, she's a novelist, and she writes about this passage, interestingly enough. And I love this little passage, so I'll read it here. These words, 7:26 and through 28 or so, have stood through time and thought, no doubt, been spoken from pulpits, used to punish uppity and opinionated women, been cited as God's actual credo on the female subject. These are words that have done historical harm, and yet they were probably written in the same short-sighted spirit that any gender uses in complaining about the other. That barstool spleen, taken as divine revelation, casts a sick pall upon the acquired wisdom of Kohelet.
Wow.
It's a really apt comment about what happens when we make something scripture.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, but yeah.
No, that's important.
Yeah, that's good stuff, isn't it? And makes you reflect on how something that maybe wasn't intended to be timeless truth has been made into timeless truth. I don't regret that in a lot of ways. But I'm glad that we have what's in Kohelet because there's a lot of great stuff there. I'll get to that. But
we got to take your medicine, really, then you can have your sugar.
Careful. Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, one of the things that Zach and I try to do on the podcast is, I mean, we try to pick some things that we think are interesting, but also some of these more problematic passages, in part because people don't realize they're in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, they may not realize that it's been used in particular ways. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I wasn't fully aware. I couldn't tell you the last time I opened Ecclesiastes. So there's that. But yeah, definitely not aware of how much. I don't know if I would have read that and thought, oh, this could be used for violence against women, but somebody did, and it's important for me to know that.
So we should get to the theme of the book.
Yes.
Which is Havel.
Yes.
So this interesting, elusive, perplexing Hebrew word, Havel, it appears about 38 times. There's one place it's a little debatable, and that's a lot of times. That's more than half the number of times the word is used in the whole canon.
Oh, wow.
And there is a lot of debate about how to translate this one word in the book. And so the decision I make is not to translate it.
Okay.
So I just refer to it as Havel throughout in transliteration. So I just write it H-E-V-E-L, which is how you would say it. I think that it's very useful because then you can let the book tell you what the word means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the tricky thing is when you're looking at an English translation, there are a few translations. The NET translation is probably the best example here. There are a few translations that change the translation of Havel depending on where it is in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that because it does have different meanings in different places.
But then it misleads your audience into thinking it's different words.
Exactly.
And it's the same. So you don't recognize the multivalence of the single word.
Right. Right. Okay. So the traditional translation is vanity. Mm-hmm. But I find that most people think vanity is a piece of furniture. Mm-hmm. And so that's not very helpful. Or it's being self-centered.
Right.
And that I don't think that's what Kohelet means either. there are so many different possibilities. Worthless, elusive, insubstantial, in a very concrete way. It's a puff of air or a puff of smoke. It's also the same word that's used for Abel's name in Genesis. So maybe there's something to that. I mean, I have a long list of possibilities, and it's not hard to find those at all. But I think that the best thing to do is to find out what this author thinks that word means. And so if you use a translation like the NRSV that chooses one translation throughout vanity, then you know what that is.
Right.
Sure.
And I mean, it might almost be good if you printed off a copy of the book on just regular paper and, you know, put black marker over every time it says vanity or vanities or some version of that word, then you have to let the context fill it in for you. So I think that's an interesting thing to do there. If I had to pick a translation, I would pick Absurdity or Absurd, which was popularized by Michael V. Fox, which has been debated actually recently in the journals. And Fox makes the case that Camus defines absurdity in a way that describes what Kohelet is describing.
Okay.
And I'm convinced by that. The idea is that what you expect and what happens do not match up.
Okay.
And so it's unfulfilled expectations would be one way to say that. What's supposed to happen and what actually happens are not the case.
Right.
Now, a number of people have said, oh, it's anachronistic, you know, Camus wrote way after Kohelet. I mean, I still think they're kind of talking about the same thing. And if you have to pick a word, a French philosopher, right? So Myth of Sisyphus.
Yeah.
He talks about, that's a good example. His discussion about the myth of Sisyphus, the guy who is punished, the Greek god who's punished to push a big rock up a hill over and over and he'll never get to the top. And so that sense of frustration and you never get ahead. That's another theme in Kohelet, is the Hebrew word yitron, advantage or something like that. Can you ever get ahead? No. So
preach.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So anyway, so this word fills the book. The other theme that draws in a lot of people is what I call carpe diem. Most scholars refer to it this way. And so 7 times in the book, Kohelet says some version of eat and drink and enjoy your life. So we summarize that with the Latin carpe diem. And sometimes it's not quite as cheery as eat and drink and enjoy your life. It's just enjoy your work.
Right.
Or something like that. But often the carpe diem is in the same vicinity as Hevel. So my interpretation is that for Kohelet, the carpe diem doesn't solve the Hevel of life, but it at least is the best distraction we can find.
Okay.
And Hevel is just prevalent. So it opens and closes the book. It's in 1:1 and 12, I think 8. Then there's a little epilogue after that. And in 1:1, it repeats over and over. Haval Havelim. So there's 2 times, says Kohelet. Haval Havelim. Everything is Hevel. So that 5 times.
Yeah.
In 8 words verse, or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Right. In variations. It's just pervasive. And to me, in chapter 8, Kohelet says really one of the most profound things related to both Hevel and carpe diem. So I'll read, this is 8:14 through 15 in the New Revised Standard Version. And if you look at this, it's even better to kind of zoom out and read more of the chapter. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I mean, preach, right?
Right.
Do I hear an amen? Has anybody noticed that? Mm. There are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous, which is a beautiful little poetic piece.
Yeah.
It mirror, those lines mirror each other. We call it chiasm, and it, the language repeats. It just draws your attention. And also because suddenly you're thinking of, you know, that 8-year-old kid who died of leukemia, right, or you're thinking of the, just the injustice in the world of the,
or Nazi soldiers who got to live to the 90 something.
Exactly.
With no justice.
Exactly.
Done.
Right. Yes. Right. The billionaire who takes advantage of the poor who has luxuries galore.
Right.
And so then Kohelet says, I said, you love how the voice breaks in here. I said that this also is hevel, vanity. So I commend enjoyment, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves. For this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun. To me, those two verses really encapsulate what Kohelet is doing, pointing out injustice, where things don't work the way they should, and that's hevel, and then pairing it with carpe diem. And I like to think about, is carpe diem, is it a party? Is it really joy? Yeah. Is it stress eating?
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In other words, is it a solution or is it just a distraction? I tend to think it's more of a distraction, but that's me. One of my favorite comments about Kohelet is from Julie Duncan, who has her own very excellent commentary on Ecclesiastes in the Abingdon Press series. But I quote this from her. She told me that she didn't put it in her book. She calls Kohelet a Rorschach test for the interpreter.
Mm. Oh,
there's so much ambiguity there. It's really impossible not to put ourselves in it. So I'm always a little fearful that my read of Kohelet makes me quite a pessimist. But I think it's just my read
of
the book.
Well, let me make it more pessimistic. I mean, what of this audience eating and drinking and being merry aren't really options? I mean, there are people in the world today where the distraction of just go eat and drink just is, man, that's a luxury in and of itself. Clean water is a luxury. And so, I mean, there's definitely this even more dark element to it of like, there is no distraction for you because you can't trust that you can eat. Clean water's not available. Be merry. What a joke kind of thing. So I think there's even, what does that say? My Rorschach reading of this.
No, I think that's reality. I think that's so good. And to me, that's the importance of a feminist commentary, is to look at those marginalized voices that aren't represented here. I've had a number of students who will say, for instance, about the enjoy your toil. That is such a luxury perspective. Who gets to pick their life's work in a way that they can enjoy it? That's not everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and you have the food, like you said?
And thinking about, so some of this is, I just finished rereading Elie Wiesel's Night.
Oh, gosh.
Again. So like last week I just read it again. And so thinking about that in context of this, and this being a Jewish scripture that he probably was very familiar with, because he was quite pious before he was put in the camps, and how eat, drink, and be merry is a spit in his face in those camps. Enjoy your work is a spit in the face in those camps. And so how does your particular context, even when this is sacred scripture to you, how do you read it? I mean, I'm not trying to take super dark turn here, but that's for me right now, that's sort of the intertextual connections I'm making, is his biography there and his autobiography, and then how he might have read this text. And so
I think that's a great point of connection. And what I did with that in terms of a feminist hermeneutic is to say, wait a minute, can I eat, drink, and be merry if I have to fix and serve the food?
Mm-hmm.
Because in an ancient context, and frankly in a modern context, for women, that's often been the case, and still is for many women, most women, that they're the ones who have to prepare the food and serve the food. Mm-hmm. Do you get carpe diem?
Yeah.
If that happens.
Yeah, if that's your position.
I mean, I don't really have a definitive answer to that. Right. I don't really like to cook that much personally. So for me, carpe diem involves eating out. But somebody else cooked my food.
Yeah.
And somebody else is going to serve it and clean it up.
Yeah.
So is that carpe diem for them? I don't know.
Yeah.
The other thing I got to delve into there was the issue of ancient beer making.
Oh.
So in chapter 11, verse 1 is one of the most perplexing verses in the book. Send out your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will get it back. So, I mean, what do you think that sounds like?
Like soggy bread?
Right. I mean, traditionally, yeah, a lot of people have said it's about wise investing or something like that. Or even about being charitable.
Okay.
But Michael Homan and Jenny Ebling, who have done a lot of research on ancient beer making, said it does sound like soggy bread, which is how you made beer.
Yeah, exactly.
In the ancient world. Yeah. And they still make beer like that in parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. And then you would drink it with a straw that has little holes on the end, or you would strain out the beer. Yeah, exactly. And beer was a staple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the alcohol would kill the impurities in the water. It wasn't very high alcohol content. But you would bake bread, put it in water, and, let the little bioorganisms do their magic. And then you have beer. So in a household context, Jenny Ebling, in her great research, has shown women probably would have done this because they baked the bread.
Yeah.
And so, to me, that was a really interesting place where women might be hiding in Qohelet. This idea of maybe 11:1 is about beer making, and if it was, it was about women. Mm-hmm. Of course, Qohelet doesn't mention them.
Yeah, right.
But it's fun to think about them there.
Where they're hiding in the text.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I guess I can make beer at home.
Yeah, just get some water.
Well, so, right, I was thinking about that, too.
Make some beer in the bathtub.
Is the beer as fun if you have to make it? I mean, I know people who love great beer and then they make it.
Yep.
But if you had to make it, right? I don't know.
Yep. Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So in our last few minutes then, did you have anything else that you definitely wanted to bring up? You mentioned something about fear God.
Well, fear God also appears 5 times.
Okay.
Carpe diem appears 5 times. I think God is fearsome to Qohelet.
Mm.
Not in the just, you
like
know,
an awe like
and wonder,
afraid.
But actually afraid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that was, a very normal thing in the ancient world. You needed your deity to be fearsome because your deity needed to be able to take care of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one other thing is maybe the poem in chapter 3, because that's what most people are familiar with.
Right.
And then, I told Jill earlier that I think most people hear that poem 3:1-8. You know, it's the Pete Seeger bird song.
Right.
To everything, turn, 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 turn.
Turn,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, sing.
To oh gosh, I can't remember. Great harmonies. That like late 70s or whatever harmony.
Right.
Like tight harmonies. Yeah.
So the thing is that I think, and I'm not alone in this, that probably Qohelet lifted that poem. That's not really Qohelet's poem. Qohelet comments on it.
Mm.
And if you read later on in chapter 3 what Qohelet says, I think Qohelet's saying, maybe there's a time for everything, but damn it, we don't know what that time is. God made us so that we want to know, but we cannot find out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So eat, drink, and be merry.
Yeah, because all is hevel. Yeah. And incidentally, probably the best translation of the opening line is not there's a time to be born, but there's a time to give birth.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So one thing that I did is
so is there a passive verb? Or can it go either way?
I don't remember. I'd have to look. So I ran through every verb in that poem and I said I looked everywhere else in the Hebrew Bible canon to see where those verbs were connected, if those verbs were connected with women as a subject in the sentence with that verb.
Oh, okay.
And most of them are.
Yeah.
So I don't think that means necessarily that a woman wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my editor, Atalia Brenner, has a section in here. She makes a case that that poem really argues for a male voice there, or an M voice. A male perspective, let's say. But I think it does mean that maybe women could have related to it.
Yeah.
Because most of the verbs are things that would have involved women one way or another.
Right. All right. So how do you see Qohelet's place in the canon? It's a big question.
Right.
I'm hearing a lot of, personally, I'm hearing a lot of connections with like the questions raised in Job about why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? So I see some of that here, although maybe, is it, do you think it's as bleak as Job? I mean, you're not getting any answers in Job either. God's like, who do you think you are to ask these questions and to get the answers kind of thing?
Whether it's bleak or not, I think depends a lot on your perspective.
Rorschach.
To me, yeah. I really see Qohelet as a realist, and I would much prefer people to tell me the truth than to pretend mm-hmm. things are better than they are. Now, the reason I'm glad that Qohelet is in a wider canon is because there are other books where I can find hope mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. a call to service, for instance, yeah. which we don't get in Qohelet. Qohelet doesn't think about other people in the ways that we are called to think about other people in other parts right. of the canon. For me as a Christian, the canon includes the New Testament too. And so for me, those are really important dialogue partners mm-hmm. with Qohelet. But I find it utterly naive to only focus on the hope and the promise of service and that kind of thing without facing the realities of, for instance, the righteous are treated according to the acts of the wicked and the wicked are treated according to the acts of the righteous. So that's why I'm really glad that Qohelet is there. The other thing, though, is I think for most people, Qohelet is not in the canon, essentially. It's not in their canon. Most people don't open Qohelet. Except for, like I said, the one part that Qohelet probably didn't write that Qohelet was commenting on 3:1-8. So that's too bad.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people who are reflecting on the realities of life, the difficulties of life, the hard questions, I think that it can be kind of a cathartic book. My colleague Harold Washington called it astringent. Mm-hmm. And not only is that, I think, healthy self-reflection, I think it can also be kind of reassuring for a lot of us to know that we're not the first ones with those questions. And I love that it got canonized. I mean, it was debated, but I love that it's in there.
Well, thank you for telling us all about your book. Go pick it up.
Go buy it.
Liturgical Press.
We will provide links to Uppity Women for sure, because if you're looking for maybe something video for a church context,
yeah,
I think that's probably a good place to go. And then, of course, links to pick up the other things that you've published. So, please leave us a 5-star review.
Be nice.
If you got 3 stars for us, I am not interested. Any parting words, Dr. Wolf?
Eat and drink and enjoy your life.
I like it.
And everything is hevel.
Everything is hevel. So, all right. Well, we will catch you next time. Amen and Selah.